This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. In direct talks among the warring factions in Yemen aimed at ending their four-year conflict are to get underway Thursday at a castle outside Stockholm. UN envoy Martin Griffiths will reportedly shuttle between the Houthi rebel delegation and representatives of the Saudi-backed Yemen government. Mideast Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal said these are not truly peace negotiations.
This is basically intended to, quote-unquote, build some degree of confidence between the two opposing parties so they can go back and talk to their supporters and work out something which may allow for some compromise down the road.
He said both sides are under pressure to end the conflict, with the Houthis coping with internal divisions, while the Saudis are under pressure from Western backers to end a conflict that appears to have no military solution. These are the first talks since 2016 and take place amid a growing humanitarian crisis. Geert Kapilari is the UN Children's Agency Regional Director.
On behalf of UNICEF, but more importantly, on behalf of every single of the 15 million children in Yemen, there is only one message to those who are gathering today in Sweden. That is the message of peace for this brutal war. The brutal war on children raging throughout the country for too long for that war to stop now.
Griffiths is seeking immediate efforts to reopen the Sana'a airport, complete a prisoner swap, and reach a truce in the fighting for the key port city of Hodeida. The first UN-backed discussions on the future of Western Sahara since 2012 opened in Geneva Wednesday. The Moroccan government, representatives of the Polisario Front, which fought a war over the former Portuguese colony until a 1991 ceasefire, are taking part in 2 days of talks with Algeria and Mauritania. This is VOA News. The French government Wednesday said it's abandoning plans to hike fuel prices following weeks of sometimes violent protests.
Si l'État doit rester fort et ferme,
speaking to the National Assembly, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said the state, to remain strong and stable, must guarantee public order. He said no tax is worth putting the nation's unity at risk. The government backtracked from its plan, unveiled a day earlier, to suspend the fuel price increase for 6 months, intended to combat climate change. Meanwhile, the government is planning a delay in the rise of the minimum food price, prompting a farmers group to call for street action in opposition. Russian President Vladimir Putin responding to a U.S. ultimatum to withdraw from an arms control agreement over Russia's claims of noncompliance said Wednesday that Moscow would be forced to respond. He said the American side has now decided the situation on previous restrictions has changed. He said our side's response is simple. We will do the same. Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Moscow it had 60 days to end its violations of the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or a six-month period of withdrawal would commence. At issue is a new Russian missile, the SSC-8. The U.S. says violates the treaty. The Kremlin says it does not. Americans said goodbye Wednesday to the late former President George H.W. Bush with a state funeral at Washington's National Cathedral. Among those delivering eulogies of the 41st president, his son George W. Bush, the 43rd chief executive.
When the history books are written, they will say that George H.W. Bush was a great president of the United States, a diplomat of unmatched skill, a commander-in-chief of formidable accomplishment, and a gentleman who executed the duties of his office with dignity and honor.
His father, who died Friday at age 94, will be buried Thursday on the grounds of his presidential library and museum in College Station, Texas. The foreign ministers of the NATO alliance meeting in Brussels Wednesday affirmed support for the 17-year conflict in Afghanistan, despite mounting casualties and a lack of peace talks. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg counseled resolve.
As we now try to move forward towards a real peace process, we have seen from other conflicts that sometimes there is an uptick, an increase in violence, because the different parties try in a way to gain the best possible position at the negotiating table.
He called for continued support for Afghan security forces as they increase their own capabilities. U.S. markets closed Wednesday by the National Day of Mourning, but U.S. stock futures tumbled after Canada arrested a top official of China's telecom giant Huawei. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today's Thursday, December 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The South Sudan Army and Presidential Guard are being sued today for sexual violence against women and girls.
What we want to do by lodging this complaint at the UN Committee is to remind the international community of the brutal sexual violence that is taking place on a daily level against tens of thousands of South Sudanese women and girls.
Antonia Mulvey is Executive Director of Legal Action Worldwide. The South Sudan government says the group has a hidden agenda for further polarizing the country. Sudan's parliament wants to change the constitution for President Bashir to run again in 2020. But the opposition says it's all a smokescreen to avoid the ICC. And Angola's president meets with his critics in civil society.
It looks like, at least for now, a moon situation between the government of President João Lourenço and civil society and human rights groups, which has been very critical against the government.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpa-Avai in Luanda. The International Vaccine Alliance, known as Gavi, withdraw its support from Kenya, and Congo's Ebola crisis spreads to Butembo, a city of 1 million people. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The group Legal Action Worldwide says it will today, Thursday, file a legal case at the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in Geneva against the South Sudan Army and Presidential Guard for sexual violence against women and girls during attacks on their villages from June 2016 to September 2017. Antonia Mulvey, Executive Director of Legal Action Worldwide, says her group is bringing the case on behalf of 30 women and girls who were subjected to sexual violence by government security forces.
All of them were raped and gang raped, and some subjected to sexual slavery. And they're now refugees and asylum seekers in the neighboring country of Uganda and unable to currently return to South Sudan. And it's only because they are not in South Sudan that we've been able to take their statement.
This case is going to be lodged at the UN Committee on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in Geneva. Could you tell me the process and how is South Sudan going to be held accountable?
They will review the complaint and a copy will be sent to the South Sudan government for comment. It's for this reason that we have protected the identities of the survivors who've made the complaint against the government. And then we will be able to comment on behalf of our client.
This particular case about the situation in South Sudan and the case against the South Sudan Army and the Presidential Guard, is this something that is going to go to ICC?
At this time, we can't say that this case will go to the ICC. However, what we want to do by lodging this complaint at the UN Committee is to remind the international community of the brutal sexual violence that is taking place on a daily level against tens of thousands of South Sudanese women and girls, babies as young as 2 years old. And at the moment, there is very few opportunities for legal redress. It is possible if a member state referred the case to the ICC, but currently that's not happening at the moment, so we don't anticipate it to happen.
Cases like this that you're talking about were previously reported by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the response from the government of South Sudan is normally that such cases are just aimed at tarnishing their image or such reports are false. How would you react to them if they dismissed this case where you have spoken to people who went through this rape?
Unfortunately, it's extremely common that governments deny the actions of their state agents, which includes the military, police, or border guard police. So the standard response, particularly to sexual violence, is to deny that it occurred in the first place. Under international law, the testimony of one individual is sufficient and counts as evidence. We have 30 statements from individuals who are raped, gang raped, and some subjected to mass gang rape. I think the information supported by UN and credible international NGO reports such as Amnesty International speaks for itself. And the denial of the government, I mean, just shows and indicates their unwillingness to address this issue.
Antonia Mulvey is Executive Director of Legal Action Worldwide. She spoke with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. The South Sudan government has accused the think tank human rights lawyers known as Legal Action Worldwide of having a hidden agenda against the South Sudan government. Presidential spokesman Atain Wek Atain says Legal Action Worldwide wants to return South Sudan to polarization away from the positive movement prevailing in the country towards implementation of the peace agreement signed in September this year in Khartoum and Addis Ababa.
First of all, I thought such a legal group could have had ability to understand and appreciate the inflicted into South Sudanese women by individual soldiers. The government of South Sudan has demonstrated the capacity to punish and take those violators into books. And what gives those legal white groups the mandate and the prerogative to sue governments is something they should explain better, because the government of South Sudan has already done it first, and the government of South Sudan is not guilty and should not be guilty, because South Sudan is not the only country where individual soldiers take law into their own hands. But it is only when the government of the day in a given country fails to bring the violators to book, that's where the government can be thought to have failed to do its duty as a government of the day.
So this time period that they are talking about, June 2016 to September 2017, are you admitting that some individual South Sudanese soldiers might have done something like this?
No, I'm not suggesting that. But I was actually responding on the balance of probability. If there were individuals who have taken law into their own hands, the government of South Sudan was capable of bringing them to books, like it has done before in the case of Tehran Hotel and the many other cases whereby soldiers are held accountable and then put into jail for crimes against humanity. But to speak specifically about this group, I think this group has hidden agenda, given that the whole world now is almost talking about the peace agreement that was signed on the 12th of September 2018 in Khartoum and Addis Ababa. There is a positive talk about that peace agreement being implemented. And that group, which has had a hidden agenda, wanted to put South Sudan back into polarization. They wanted to divert the attention of the government of South Sudan away from implementing peace agreement, which it has clearly demonstrated, and it is now will to implement peace agreement. So that group is a group with a hidden agenda, I can say at the least.
One of the accusations here is that the government has done nothing to hold accountable the soldiers who allegedly committed these acts. But you are saying that your government has taken actions. Can you outline for me what steps your government has taken so far?
The government of South Sudan has demonstrated time and again that if an individual soldier has taken law into his or her own hand, the government of South Sudan is an institution that deals with this kind of perpetrators, and they are always locked up. Some are locked up for life, gentlemen, and some are locked up for long years in prison. This was not done by the group of lawyers sitting in the Western world. It is done by the government of South Sudan, considering that government of South Sudan has sovereignty over its own territory, and to bring to book those who are perpetrating crimes. It is not a business of these people, and they should mind their own business.
South Sudan presidential spokesman Atain Wek Atain, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. The Speaker of Sudan's parliament says he has received a letter signed by a majority of lawmakers supporting a constitutional amendment for President Omar al-Bashir to seek another term in 2020. Ibrahim Ahmed Omar says the lawmakers see President Bashir as the protector of the people. But Mariam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, vice president of the opposition National Umar Party and also deputy secretary of the opposition and civil society umbrella group known as Sudan Call, says the move is all a smokescreen to enable President Bashir to evade going to the International Criminal Court, where he is wanted for war crimes.
It is quite expected. They have been gathering the support to violate the constitution to have another term for the president. But the funny thing now, they say it might be for life, that they can renew for him the terms for unlimited times. This is not the first time that such so-called reforms for the constitution are done to solidify the strength of the Sudanese president and to give him more powers. And they have been harassing even members of the ruling party not to object to such reform.
Madam, the Speaker of the Parliament, Ibrahim Ahmed Omar, says that he has received a memorandum from 33 political parties who are representing 294 deputies to amend the constitution. And he says that this is in line with the constitution.
Well, he's talking about the procedural aspect of having reform from within the constitution for the constitution. Of course, this is the first step. Then the second step, to have the approval of the parliament, they have to take it to the both chambers, the House of Senate, the parliament, in different sessions, and they must get 3/4 of the votes of the two chambers. Then it is supposed to go to be taken to a referendum by the people. Of course, this is all, as you see, there is a lot of expenditure of time and effort and money. Resources in that for something which is already quite nonsensical. This president, sitting president, has been sitting for the last 30 years with the secession of the country, with wars widespread in all over Sudan, and with serious economic collapse to the extent now people are ordered to buy the bread through providing their national numbers. And there is serious inflation with corruption and lack of transparency and lack of basic freedoms and serious violations of human rights everywhere. So for such a devastating rule to ask to change the constitution to get another term or unlimited term of governance, this is a serious manifestation not only of autocracy but total lack of vision by the ruling junta.
Mariam Al-Sadiq Al-Mahdi is vice president of the opposition National Umma Party of Sudan. She was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 6th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Doctors Without Borders has urged the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, Gavi, not to withdraw its support for Kenya, citing unstable economy. Speaking in Nairobi, MSF Research Communication and Analysis Advisor Kim West said that despite a growing economy, Kenya's investments in health have remained around 4%. Maureen Odhiambo reports.
The Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, Gavi, in 2016 declared Kenya a middle-income country despite the challenges Kenya is facing in health sector. Kenya continues to rely on external aid to fund its health programs, with donor funding accounting to 57.1% of the budget. Addressing the media in Nairobi, the Doctors Without Borders Research Communication and Analysis Advisor Kim West said that the Kenyan government, as per now, has got no capacity to fund various vaccinations that have always been funded by Gavi.
And what we are concerned about is, I guess, in the first instance, is the government capacity to take on this extra financing that's going to be left by Gavi. Secondly, and we would argue that not enough attention is paid to these latter issues, is that the way Gavi assesses its eligibility for support is based on one indicator that isn't so representative of the health situation in a country.
Gavi has threatened to withdraw its funding for a period of 10 years, a move that Doctors Without Borders says will negatively affect children's health in Kenya. Kim says Gavi Alliance should look into the effects that withdrawal will have to Kenya before considering the move.
Because we have some concerns about what it means, you know, for the health worker delivering vaccines in the health facility, will they have access to the same vaccines they've always had access to? Will coverage decrease? We don't know.
Kenya has been faulted for lack of transparency around the level of donor funding for key programs such as HIV and AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, productive health and immunization. The Doctors Without Borders suggest that the government should focus on enriching the standards of National Hospital Insurance Fund that has since then seen its chief executive officer, Geoffrey Mwangi, behind bars because of fund embezzlement. Appearing before anti-corruption court, Mwangi and his acting finance director counterpart, Wilbert Kurgat, denied charges and were released on bail. The two were ordered by court's Chief Magistrate Francis Andai to cooperate with investigators probing the possible loss of 2 billion Kenya shillings at the state agency. A report by the Overseas Development Institute stated that too much of Kenya's budget and human resources is directed towards curative rather than preventive care, a strategy that does not create a conducive environment for sustaining immunization programs. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Angolan President João Lourenço this week met with a cross-section of civil society groups and human rights activists who had been critical of his government policies. Here is veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpa Avai in Luanda.
According to the news and the civil society leaders which has been participated in the meeting, they say they were surprised by this kind of meeting because it was the very first time the last president, Dos Santos, never met civil society and human rights groups, which has been very critical against the former MPLA government. And they say they thank the president for the openness and allowing them to expose the main current questions concerning human rights. One of the questions that President João Lourenço has been discussing with the civil society groups was the situation concerning the so-called risgat operations against people which are selling on the streets. The president said they need to clarify these operations is not against the people and especially the ladies who start selling goods on the streets and in the informal market, but it's an operation to reinstall the authority of the state.
Mario, during Tuesday's meeting, journalist Rafael Marquette was supposed to be a member of the civil society delegation, but we learned that he was not allowed to enter the presidential palace. But now there's a story that on Wednesday, the president met with Rafael. What happened yesterday and why today the president had to meet with him?
Yes, James. It was really a sad event on Tuesday that journalist Rafael Marquez was the only one to be blocked by the security agents and the officials in the presidential palace to enter the meeting, alleging because he wasn't on the invitation list. But later, even on Tuesday, there was an official news that a presidential officials called Rafael invited him to meet the president on Wednesday, which really happens. Journalist Rafael Marquez also appears on TV after, I would say, a 45 meeting this Wednesday with the president, saying that he gets the president for his openness, and the president also gave the excuses for the said incident on Tuesday. And Mr. Rafael said he was talking with the president about a number of cases of human rights violations and corruptions.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. A strike by Zimbabwe medical doctors is in its third day, with the government refusing to give in to their demands to be paid in foreign currency. Columbus Mavunga has the latest from Harare.
Zimbabwe's doctors have been striking since Monday to force the government to pay them in foreign currency, not the local currency known as bond notes, which have been losing value. Here is Health Minister Obadiah Moyo responding to the doctors' demands.
We don't want to lie to each other or waste each other's time. We all know that there is no foreign currency to even buy the medicines which they use in hospitals, let alone foreign currency to be paying to individuals.
As the two sides bicker, a woman cries at Zimbabwe's Parenyatwa Hospital after death of her mother-in-law. The woman says her mother-in-law had not been attended to since Tuesday afternoon after being involved in an accident. Patients continue to be turned away because of the doctor's strike, as Rumbizai Machka, a 60-year-old high blood pressure patient, tells me. She says, we were supposed to have blood tests, but they have turned us down, saying doctors are on strike and we cannot get that done as my blood might go bad before the strike ends, she says. A few loved ones have been helped, said this patient, who refused to be identified. We were attended to. We saw our doctor and we had X-ray scans. There are other patients who are affected by the situation who were turned away and were told to rebook. For years now, Zimbabwe's health sector has been hurting as much as the country's economy. Medical services have been largely funded by Western organizations such as the USAID and the European Union. Medical staff have gone on strike multiple times, demanding that their workplaces be equipped with modern technology and adequate medicines. The opposition movement for democratic change on Wednesday urged the government to meet the doctors' demands. In a statement, the opposition said the strike is a clear sign of failure for the government. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The current Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo has spread to the populated urban center of Butembo, a city of 1 million in the country. This marks a worrying development as this is the most populated city this outbreak has reached, according to a release from Medecins Sans Frontières this week.
Many seems to be stabilizing. 3 weeks ago, we were at the peak, and now we're plateauing, and it's very well controlled and very well managed by the Ministry of Health and the NGOs that are working with the MOH. On the other hand, in Butembo, things continue to pick up on a regular basis. There is another area that's close to Butembo, on the outskirts of Butembo, called Katwa, which has been picking up more and more cases. And so people are a little bit, ramping up activities and this epidemic, because it's clearly on the uptick in the Butembo Katwa area.
There are obviously increased risks in an urban area where people live close together. What are the health facilities like in Butembo that are already there? Are they sufficient to meet the community's needs, or is that a concern?
I think there is a need for more facilities, and there are definitely some actors who've been looking at where would be the best area. For now, there is, for example, nothing in Katwa, which again is on the outskirts of Butembo. And so it would be, a place to most likely intervene and have a treatment center. MSF is present already in Butembo. They have an Ebola treatment unit. It's running, close to capacity. They're extending, which I think there is definitely a need, and there will definitely be a treatment center there at some point in time, and in the very near future, I should say.
I know with contact tracing, in Beni, especially, this was an issue because of some of the insecurity in the region. Are those same problems posed in Butembo when it comes to contact tracing?
That's Karen Hoster, field coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking to Ricky Streich from Beni in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that is it for this Thursday, December 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butter in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, peepsters. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're gonna see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. So that, so that. this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.
Thank you.